Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our first topic is how phone scams are getting more sophisticated, and how one particular scam here in Ohio turned deadly. Joining us is Professor Shavik Das. He's a professor at Carnegie Mellon's Human-Computer Interaction Institute, where he researches cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
The case that made us want to do a show about phone scams happened in a small town situated between Columbus and Dayton. And it started like a regular grandparent scam, where somebody calls an older adult and pretends to have arrested a relative, often a grandchild, and demands the person pay their bail. It's a con that's been around for years, growing in popularity as more and more information about our families get posted online. So my first question, Professor Das, is what can we do to keep scammers like this from calling in the first place?
That's a great question. Now, the unfortunate reality is that there's very little we can do to prevent ourselves from getting these calls outside of the standard sort of approaches to protecting our information online. So, you know, making sure that you only reveal your information to those that you trust, being extremely vigilant about where you enter your personal information, because there's lots of phishing websites out there right now that try to emulate real websites, and they harvest all of this information and then they repackage it and sell it to third parties who mean you ill. So outside of the standard sort of like keeping your staying vigilant as to where you're entering your personal information online, there isn't a ton we can do to prevent ourselves from getting these calls, but certainly there are techniques we can use to prevent ourselves from falling prey to some of these scams.
So the next part in this phone scam story here in Ohio is where things really took a turn. So the guy being scammed, William Brock, is told that a driver is being sent to collect $12,000 in cash to pay for his nephew's bond. Brock assumed the Uber driver, named Lolitha Hall, was in on the con and demanded to know who she worked for. When Lolitha couldn't answer, he shot her three times. This is unusual, right, Professor Das? Fraudsters who work these scams usually ask for wire transfers, gift cards, cryptocurrency, right? It's unusual to have them send an actual physical driver to pick up cash.
Extremely unusual. This is a very sophisticated attack in many ways, and we're still learning a lot about this case. It's an extremely unfortunate case, and the motivations behind this attacker is a little bit unclear at the moment. It reminds me of a Black Mirror episode, in fact, of a scammer kind of using essentially a whole army of puppets to get their way. Extremely unusual and really concerning.
Yeah, Brock calls the police and says he's shot someone trying to rob him. And the actual police get on the phone with the scammer, who hangs up when they realize the real cops are on the scene. And unfortunately, Lolitha Hall died, and Brock now faces murder charges. Uber says it's investigating and trying to help officers find the account that sent Hall to Brock's home. And the ride-hailing company described Hall's death as a horrific tragedy. But thankfully, like, if I'm an Uber driver and I read this, I'm like, oh my goodness. But thankfully, you say this is a pretty rare situation.
Yes, this is an extremely rare situation. I, in fact, have not heard of another case that's similar to this, at least in the details. Now, this does sort of open up a new area of concern in some ways. So when you are sort of a gig worker working for Uber, 99.9% of the time, the commissions that you're getting are not going to be part of these scam situations. However, it is worth sort of like understanding and sort of staying vigilant to the fact that you don't actually know who's commissioning you to do this pickup. Approaching homes that you might be entering with some level of caution and trepidation might be worth sort of considering.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that you could send an Uber to go pick up a package and then deliver it to another location. And it might not just be money in a scam. I mean, you could use it to move drugs or any kind of illegal product.
Right. And, I really think the onus here must fall at some level on Uber itself for sort of facilitating this kind of exchange. The gig workers who are signing up to make extra money or perhaps even doing this as a full-time job, they're signing up sort of not like sort of deferring the responsibility of security here to the company that is overseeing this connection. Now, of course, it's not an easy problem by any means. Uber is working with limited information, of course, but I do think that if they're providing this kind of service, some of the onus of like ensuring the safety of both the people, so Lolita in this case, she was going to Mr. Brock's house over here, and neither one of them were sort of consenting to that exchange, right? And so the onus really is here on Uber. To sort of stay vigilant and keep their keep people safe.
Now, this case didn't involve artificial intelligence, but I do want to talk about it because in March, the Federal Trade Commission issued a consumer alert warning that scammers could target them over the phone using AI technology to clone the voice of a family member and basically convince them to send the scammers money. How does this work? How are they capturing our voices?
Right. So I do want to preface this by saying, there was no direct evidence that AI was involved in this particular
Yes,
case.
absolutely.
And, this is a really unfortunate case. Now, that said, generative AI technologies are essentially tools that, we can use for good things, but also we can use for bad things. OpenAI recently published this sort of technology that they're not releasing to the public, where they showed their synthetic voices, where they showed using just a 15-second voice clip was sufficient for them to replicate the voice of an individual for a variety of things that they might say. So you could imagine if you are posting content of yourself for any sort of like public or semi-public consumption on services like social media. So, for example, if you're posting anything on TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, even, the access control settings for these things is set to public, which a lot of people do because, there's this kind of boundary that we negotiate all the time when we post online about like, well, we want potentially for things to go viral if we think it's cool. If 15 seconds of your voice is out there, that is sufficient for some of these generative AI technologies to be able to replicate your voice. What can we do against that? Honestly, for many of us, the cat's out of the bag. Many of us have posted more than 15 seconds of our voices online well before these technologies existed. And so it's less a matter of like, how can we prevent these technologies from having access to our voice and more about recognizing that this technology is out there now. And so we need to be verifying information, especially information that seems kind of out of left field.
Yeah, especially I think if you heard the voice of your own kid come through the line, it would be exactly what the scammers are looking for, that visceral panic, that fear that makes you not think rationally.
Absolutely. And that's what scammers like to prey on. They like to prey on they like to get you into a state where you are less likely to be using kind of your system to brain, your kind of like slower conscious reasoning brain, and you're acting on impulse essentially.
How would I be able to tell that it was an AI generated voice of somebody that I loved? Is there any clues in like word choice, like anything that might make should make me go,
A good question. So typically, I would say that to the untrained ear, it's going to be really difficult to tell whether or not this voice is AI generated or not. Now, there are going to be some tells. So, for example, generative audio technologies aren't that sophisticated yet, even though they sound pretty good. You'll be able to tell through just sort of like micro fluctuations in the voice and things like that that sound a little bit unnatural. But I would be I don't know if a study that has done this yet. We're probably going to start to see some of these studies. We know that people are really bad at differentiating between human-generated and AI-generated text right now. There are some tells, but the layperson is often not going to be able to tell that. And my guess is that's true for these generated voices as well. So I think the best thing we can do now is to sort of double check information. So if you're getting this call, this emotionally charged call, that seems to be coming out of left field, that might be a real call. But it's also worth, for example, saying, okay, I'm going to call you right back, hang up, and then you proactively call the person who is being impacted over here. If that's an option, sometimes there it's like a payphone or something like that. Remember when those existed. Most of the time you're going to be able to sort of double check that information, sort of proactively verify that information. So it's important to sort of like take a deep breath, recognize that like we live in this new world where this could potentially be a scam. And oftentimes it's the elderly who are preyed upon by these scams. And so just sort of verifying that information proactively is the best way to go.
So if they say they're being held at X police station, call the police station and see if your person is there.
Exactly. So, say, I hear you. I'm going to call you right back, hang up the phone, and then proactively call them back or call the police station or whatever.
I also wonder if you could ask them for some sort of detail or fact, right? Like AI can mimic your voice, but it can't mimic your memories.
Absolutely. That's a good strategy. It can depend, right? Like so if you're allowed to sort of have a free conversation here, then sort of verifying through in security circles we talk about secret sharing as a way to authenticate. So this is a what you know secrets akin to a password or akin to like an autobiographical memory in some way. So if you can verify that this is the person through some sort of like secret exchange, that would also be great. So like being proactive about that. Of course, that's that's starting to get into the situation where you have to like really think on your feet in this extremely emotionally charged situation. That's not a bad idea at all. Of course, in the future, there might be situations where it seems implausible to have this free exchange. For example, if they're being held for ransom, or if they have access to like a Twitter feed. So you have to make sure that it's extremely kind of like personal to that relationship. But that's not a bad idea at all.
Kind of like how we prove who we are with those password questions.
Yeah, those challenge questions are generally not very secure, but exactly like that. So in the context of like a dyadic exchange between two humans in real time, that's a perfect analogy.
So, what other ways can we authenticate who we are or just protect ourselves? Because I feel like sometimes we're heading towards a world in which it will be really hard to separate fact from fiction.
It's true. These generative AI technologies don't help with that. I do, again, want to kind of like ground and recenter. Technology is similar to ChatGPT, have existed for some time. The bottleneck for creating scam information, misinformation, and disinformation has not really been access to these technologies, and it hasn't even really been cost. And so, in some ways, I wouldn't necessarily encourage folks to sort of think that these AI technologies are going to result in this information ecosystem where we can't trust anything, because in many ways we were already in that information ecosystem where we had to verify things before we could just believe something on the internet. However, what I do kind of want to emphasize is that the barrier to entry is a little bit lower now for multimedia content. So it's never really been easy before to automatically clone somebody's voice or automatically clone like a video feed of somebody's face. And so this is where I think generative AI lowers the barrier to entry. I still don't think the bottleneck has been like the cost of these technologies. And so I don't necessarily think it's going to be that much worse now that these technologies exist than it already has been. But again, sort of like being sort of cautious, verifying information as it comes through, not believing things just because you see it on the internet, I think is just like a good digital literacy skill for everybody to develop.
In journalism, we have a cliche: if your mother says she loves you, check it out. It's kind of that approach of trust but verify. You know, I do want to quickly talk about some of the scams that are really popping up lately, particularly, you know, involving Amazon, where they're like, "Hey, we're having trouble delivering a package." Like, you get that text, right? And it's like, we need some additional information to help it get delivered." And it's definitely a scam text. And the other one that really fascinates me is where it looks like a familiar number calling, where they're like spoofing a number that you know.
So this exists. Especially like the number, this familiar number scam is common. I've gotten calls that seem like they come from my mom, and that this is because kind of like the open SMS protocol allows for scammers to like spoof the number that's being, you know, pretend to be coming from a particular number, even though it's not. And this happens pretty frequently, and it can be freaky when you get something like this. Another thing that I've seen is it's very close to your number, or like your mom's number, or your dad's number, or something. It's just off by one, and so that's like intriguing to people as well. You know, I don't know. I don't know what to say outside of, again, it's really important to be vigilant and to not just volunteer your information just because you get a phone call. You know, one of the takeaways from this unfortunate case with William Brock and Lalitha Hall is, the bail office is never going to be calling you and like setting up a situation where somebody's going to pick up the bail directly from your home. And so just like keeping, like staying vigilant about these sorts of things, right? Like, is this a normal request that you would expect from a government agency? And just sort of like using a little bit of common sense there.
And they're absolutely not going to ask for gift cards or a wire transfer. None of that is accurate.
Right, exactly.
That was Souvik Das, an assistant professor with the Human Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're exploring how Disney is using artificial intelligence in its animated movies. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our second story is about Disney and how it's using artificial intelligence to bring its new animations to life. If you haven't seen the movie Elemental, it follows a fire element named Ember and a water element named Wade as they fall in love while trying to save Ember's family store. Here's a clip from the 2023 movie.
Mom, it's okay. He's just a friend.
Silence!
If your father find out, fire and water cannot be together.
The fire people in Elemental burn, and the water people ripple in simulations that appear almost real. But it wasn't an animator who created those movements. It was AI. Joining us now is Josh Staub, an animator for Disney and Netflix Animation, and a professor of the cinematic arts at USC. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how is AI able to create a sense of movement within these characters of fire and water?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Elemental, but just to be clear, you know, I was at Disney for many, many years. I didn't work on Elemental specifically, but you know, we often use AI or different types of simulations to recreate kind of natural occurrences, things that would be very, very difficult to do by hand, frame by frame, and somehow incorporating that into our workflow so that we we don't have to spend all the time creating the naturalistic look. Instead, we can stylize it, which I think is really what Elemental was trying to do there.
So essentially, it's giving you a bunch of base, like this is what fire would look like, and then the animator goes in and shapes it and changes it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, on projects that I worked on, for example, like Tangled was similar. Like the big issue with Tangled was Rapunzel's hair. And we knew that we needed some very complex simulations. I mean, there were millions of hairs, and we wanted it to look natural to some degree. But actually, with animation, one of the great things about it is that we don't want the natural per se. We sometimes want to incorporate, I think we use the term believability. We like the term believability more than naturalistic or realistic, because we want it to be believable, but we also need the control because we want it to be appealing, and we want it to look like it was handcrafted at the same time. So trying to figure out how to marry both of those ideas is a complex challenge.
That's really interesting to me, because I've seen other AI programs struggle to simulate waves on water, for example. They often end up looking off in a way that makes it obvious that this, quote, like realistic looking ocean is AI generated. But what you're saying is you're not concerned with that part so much, because you're going to enhance and build on it anyway.
Exactly. Like in animation, we're never trying to recreate reality exactly. We want to create maybe a heightened sense of reality, or maybe the essence of what people think of when they think of water, you know, moving water. But we actually want to make it for our purposes. You know, we want to do what we would do by hand to make it appealing, to make it often, you know, we actually in Moana is a good example. We have a character that is actually made of water. Well, we need it to look like water. Like the audience needs to see that, oh, that is water, but somehow it's unique, it's magical, it's got certain properties that make it sort of sentient or anthropomorphized. And so trying to incorporate both of those things at the same time, you know, it's a delicate balance. So we have animators and, you know, the entire team is working on a look for that character in that case. But then we also have an effects team. We have like more of a programming type team that is also developing tools that create realistic simulations, but that can be controlled by the artists.
So it sounds like AI is more of a tool in your toolbox.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's similar to kind of motion capture, you know, motion capture and animation. For those who are familiar with motion capture, it's kind of, you might have seen people wearing the suits with the little dots or little balls on it, and they run around and you capture that data, which is great for like visual effects films where you want to recreate something that is supposed to look exactly real. In animation, that's not our goal. Like, we don't want to create something that looks exactly real. We want to create something that feels handcrafted. And we might use certain tools to get us to certain places so that we get that level of believability, but not necessarily realistic.
How do animators draw the line between when to use a tool like artificial intelligence and when not?
I mean, that's such a huge, I feel like we could be here all day talking about that. Because there's a lot of lines in terms of AI for people who are familiar with, you know, all the different tools out there for generating content using AI. Yeah, I don't even know where to start with that. I will say on a film, you know, the work that we're doing is more kind of simulation. It's less, you know, taking work that other artists have created, for example, and using that database to create new material. It is really just a tool to help us get to some level of believability.
Can I ask, what is the difference between CGI and AI when it comes to building out a movie?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. A lot of people think, you know, with CGI, that it's not real artistry. Like it's people on computers pushing buttons and like magic stuff comes out. the reality is it's just artists. Like it's just artists using a different kind of tool. I paint traditionally, but I paint on my iPad. Like there's the advantage of painting on my iPad is, for one thing, it's kind of portable, and I can undo. Like if I do a paint stroke and I decide, oh, I don't like that paint stroke, I can undo it. So it's convenient in that sense. But all of the work that I've done to learn, to be an artist still applies. It's still the same exact techniques. It's just using a different tool to get there. So AI, I think, is more like, okay, I'm either absorbing a simulation or I'm incorporating something that I didn't actually do myself, but it's being incorporated into my own work, where CGI just in general is still just artists who happen to use a tool for efficiency, to create this work.
And I think one of the challenges, particularly for artists across the globe now, is people feeding their work into AI and then
Yes.
spitting out some like artificial version of it.
Totally. I mean, this is why I feel like we could talk about this for a long time, because it's just one of the many issues. I mean, AI, I think in some ways is can be an incredible tool. I think it's also can be terrifying, because there's not a lot of regulation, I feel like, right now about what can be used, like what artwork that's already been, created by actual artists can be used in the database that then can generate new material. So if you like a particular artist, theoretically you could say, oh, make me a piece of art that looks like this artist, but with my prompt, with like my kind of idea. And the artist who actually created the original material is not benefiting from that at all. So that's just a purely financial, ethical question. For me, it actually is even more of a concern as a both a professional but also as a professor, because we have students who are coming up and these, aspiring artists. And I believe strongly that, the 10,000 hours that you have to put in to become a really strong artist, is so valuable. Like the process itself to become an artist actually trains you how to think. It's not just your ability to do a particular skill. It helps you understand how to tell stories through your art. And I think when you sort of short circuit that and just kind of like take somebody else's work and put it into a generator, an art generator, you're kind of diminishing the value of that creative process. And I definitely have concerns when I'm saying to young students, like, hey, you need to eat your vegetables. Like, you need to learn perspective and anatomy. You need to learn all these things in order to become a much better artist. And I think there's a temptation there, especially for artists, to say, well, why do I need to do that if I can just generate something? Again, we could talk about this all day, but it's definitely a concern that I have for the industry.
Yeah, I think it's that sometimes it's almost the subtlety, like the small moments in an animated film that really showcase the depth of knowledge of an animator. So I was thinking of Inside Out, the first one. And at the very end, there's this moment where Riley gets embraced by her parents and she sort of sighs and leans into the embrace. And anyone who has kids like instantly recognizes that little sigh as that moment where your kid gives in to being comforted, where they've maybe been standoffish and they get, and I don't know why. I think about that moment in that a lot because it's such a small second in the movie, but it showed like I really understand the dynamic between parents and kids and that moment when they sort of soften to being comforted.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds maybe ridiculous to say this, but I think we're at a point where, as artists, and even as consumers of content, like, what is it to be human anymore? Like, and I think those kinds of moments that you describe are so important, because they resonate with us, even if I'm, you know, I'm not that character. But that's what I love about films and storytelling, is that we can empathize with another character because we've had experiences, maybe not that exact experience, but something similar, and it strikes a chord with me emotionally. I know, you know, during the writer's strike, you may have seen these signs, one of them something like this, you know, ChatGPT doesn't have my childhood trauma. You know, it's like those kinds of experiences that we as humans have in our lives, they come out in our work. And I think it really is what connects us as human beings. And, you know, I'm not one to say like, oh, AI will never be able to do this or that, because I think that's innocent to kind of think that. But I do feel like there's something about the human existence and the human condition that AI won't be able to truly replicate in a way that will provide the kind of depth of storytelling and even of visual art that that I think is important in the world.
Yeah, I sort of wonder to a degree if you had to have felt it to create it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think when I'm writing, for example, I haven't lived the life of all the characters that I'm writing, but in a way I have, because, you know, it might not be that exact experience, but I'm borrowing, either consciously or subconsciously, from my own experiences in order to create an authentic moment. I think you have to do that in order to be sort of an authentic creator, or to create something that's going to resonate with an audience.
How do you have that conversation with your students?
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, I think mostly, again, I think the temptation is surely there. And actually, we're starting to see applications that, you know, I can tell when I'm looking at it, like, okay, that's AI. Like, that's not, who knows if a year from now, 5 years from now, I'll be able to do that. But I can tell there's sort of like a synthetic, like perfection to it that you can perceive. So that's one issue. But I mean, nobody wants to, maybe people do, but eat their vegetables. Like, they don't want to go through the hard work. It's painful. But I also think that the pain, like the reward of actually creating a piece of art that you're proud of, the reward you get from that is actually a result of all the work that you put into it, and like the hard work that you put into it. I kind of think about it like a sport, for people who are interested in sports. You know, at the end of a game, if you've won the game or you've performed well, the reason that you feel jubilation is not probably actually because you won this particular game. It's because of all the work that you put in to the, it's not the game itself even, it's the practice, it's the years of, you know, effort that got you to this moment. It makes that moment so much sweeter. So if you can just generate a piece of artwork, it's like takes all of that reward away for me. So I think students, the other part that I'm dealing with, I think with my students, is they are afraid. You know, they're coming up, that they have hopes and dreams of becoming an artist in the industry, and they are concerned that will there be a place for them, you know, if corporations, you know, or big studios or whatever are using AI to actually just generate content, even if it is not as good as a real artist can create or has the depth, you know, I am concerned too that there will be a time or a period where good enough is just good enough. It's like, it wasn't created by a real artist, but it looks good to me, so let's just ship it. And I think that's a concern for artists who really want to pour themselves into their craft, and they feel like they're going to be undermined by some of this technology.
That was Josh Staub, an animator for Disney and Netflix and a professor of cinematic arts at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. Thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're getting the details on why Tesla recalled almost all of its Cybertrucks. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. America isn't the only country creating AI chatbots. There's a Chinese web company that's announced their new chatbot called the ErnieBot, and it's already amassed about 200 million users. Here to tell us more about it is Russell Holly, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So let's start with my first question, which is, why is the ErnieBot called the ErnieBot?
Ernie stands for Enhanced Representation Through Knowledge Integration.
Oh my gosh, it's an acronym.
It is definitely just an acronym, but it's not even a super great acronym, as knowledge starts with a K in America. So for us, it doesn't like fully spell out E-R-N-E.
Oh, it should be Erky.
E-R-N-I, rather.
It should be Erky, huh?
That's right.
Oh, I was hoping there was like a Sesame Street reference, but I guess not. So
no, not this time.
So U.S. consumers have access to ChatGPT and others like Gemini, Copilot. Why aren't these available in China?
So there's a couple of different reasons. There's actually a lot of countries that ChatGPT isn't currently available in, some for legislative reasons, you know, the ability to consume that language and its media has doesn't have the same level of access that that we do in the US and the UK. So there are a couple of countries where ChatGPT just already isn't available, and China is one of them for a lot of the same reasons that Google isn't available there, or Facebook, and you know, versions of that. It is that American companies don't put in the extra work in order to censor themselves to meet the needs and the demands of the Chinese government. And so frequently, you know, there are very similar versions of these popular US tools that exist in China. One of them is search. Google search is not used in China, and they use a service called Baidu instead. Baidu's search engine is by far the biggest search engine in China, and they are the company that is responsible for this chatbot.
So ByteDance, which is the parent company of TikTok, also based in China, are they? It sounds like they're working on their own version. Is that correct?
That's right. ByteDance as an organization is working on a competitor to this Ernie platform, mostly to offer competition with Baidu in general. Something that is very much true in China, just as it is here in the US, is that both versions of the TikTok app, there are a lot of younger people who are using that platform as a search alternative. Instead of going to Google and saying, what is the best restaurant in this area? They're looking it up on TikTok. And it's very much the same in China. They go to a province they've never been to before. They look for, you know, what's good in that area. They're not using Baidu as much as they had before. And I think that just has to do with, you know, this a new generation that is acknowledging, you know, someone who has seen and done and touched the thing versus, you know, a perceived experience behind a website.
So can we access Ernie here in the United States?
Ernie is not something that is very easy to access here in the US. There are some workarounds you can do with VPNs in order to try and kind of muscle your way through it. But in most cases, it's just not worth the effort to go and do it, as a lot of the demonstrations and tests that have been done so far show that Ernie, which has been around for just over a year so far, this is in its fourth iteration that's being talked about this week, is claims to be pretty close to on par with what we know ChatGPT is capable of, both in the positive and the negative. In fact, you know, there's a lot of the kind of hallucination effect that we've seen with a lot of different AI tools here in the US that are actually more prevalent in some of the Chinese versions because they have access to less information due to Chinese censorship.
I think it's so fascinating to look across the country and see what kind of apps and internet search engines we do and don't have access to. Like, the Chinese government just announced that they want Apple to take, like, WhatsApp and a bunch of messaging services off their platforms.
Yes, that's exactly right. There are tools that are just more commonly used over in China. Really, like, the culture of a different app for every purpose just doesn't exist over there. There are frequently, you know, social media platforms that are also default payment mechanisms, not just from person to person, but like when you walk into a store, you know, paying with the equivalent version of WhatsApp is just common over there.
So let's talk about Tesla and its Cybertruck. So the Cybertruck is a steel-clad electric pickup that's made by Tesla. And it really looks like something out of Back to the Future. Like, I was trying to think about how to describe it if you've never seen one on the radio. And the best I could come up with is like a gray rectangle with a triangle on top.
It's a series of extreme angles. And when you look at it, it really doesn't look like anything else on the road. And to be honest, that design is one of the promises of electric vehicles, you know, gas vehicles, in order to meet all of the fuel and safety standards, they've really started to kind of homogenize. And a lot of them look very similar. If you're not a car person, then, you know, you see a car on the road, it's a gray car that looks pretty similar to most other cars. The promise of electric cars for a little while now is not needing to follow all of those regulations so tightly. So you can be a little adventurous with the design. And we're seeing that with a couple of other companies, but Tesla took it to just about as far an extreme as one could take, you know, given current techniques for building things.
And it's recalling almost all of them now because of a problem with the accelerator pedal. That sounds like a big problem.
So over the last couple of weeks, there have been a number of small issues that have been found and dealt with in various ways. The back door, it shuts quite aggressively in ways that can actually damage fingers and is a great deal more dangerous than several other, you know, manufacturers that have similar functions. There are some assemblage issues where it's clear that, like, you shut a door and it doesn't look like the panels, you know, kind of line up like they're supposed to. A lot of these kind of smaller one-off issues have popped up over the last couple weeks and seen, some of the issues for the, I think there's only like 4,000 of these on the market, you know, on the road right now. But there was a user who submitted a video to a couple of different social media sites where the metal plate that wraps around the accelerator actually dislodged from the accelerator and became wedged underneath of one of the panels underneath of the car in such a way that forced the accelerator into 100% output while the car was in motion. Now, nobody was harmed, and it's pretty easy to save yourself from this if you are in this situation, as like many electric vehicles, pressing down on the brake actually completely nullifies what the accelerator command is giving, which is very different from the way that gas cars
and
function in
know.
A lot of places. Yes, and very good to know. But that's still a pretty scary, you know, issue to encounter quite randomly, and not something you see with most cars.
Yeah, so they're recalling them, and do we have any sense of, like, what that's going to mean? Like, how long are we talking to get it fixed? Like, if you own one of these, because, I mean, these are trucks that hit and exceed $100,000.
Yes, these are incredibly expensive cars, and the way that they are solving the problem with this incredibly expensive car is having you bring your vehicle into one of the Tesla dealerships, where they have someone on hand who will drill a hole in the accelerator and place a single rivet at the bottom.
So it's a pretty quick fix.
To hold it in place. Yeah, it's not supposed to take more than, you know, a couple minutes to fix. It's not exactly the most attractive fix, and it's a pretty uncommon fix compared to what you would expect from, you know, how dealers would trust a $100,000 car. But that is the solution to getting your car back on the road in a way that that does not, potentially cause extreme damage for this giant vehicle that is now in existence.
And Tesla has had recalls on other models too, which sort of raises the question whether, like, there's a quality control issue there.
There have been a lot of reports of quality controls issues across all of, you know, the Tesla ecosystem ever since Tesla announced that they were building these pop-up factories where vehicles were essentially being assembled in very big tents. There have been issues with panels not lining up quite right, or, accessories falling off, or electronics not working exactly the way that they are expected to work. None of these are particularly insurmountable, and every single car company has versions of these kind of small problems. The issue that you're running into into here is just the volume relevant to how many cars with the Tesla brand are on the road. There's just a much higher percentage of Teslas that have these weird little issues that, you know, compared to just about any other US manufacturer. And that is one of several reasons why there are, you know, investigations into the creation of these vehicles.
Finally, let's talk about nothing. Or nothing wireless earbuds. The tech company has released its third generation of their wireless earbuds, and they're simply called the Ear. So can you describe these for us?
Yeah, so Nothing is a weird company. They do some really cool stuff. There are some things that are really interesting, but it is really hard to talk about this phone for exactly what you just highlighted. You know, if you're talking about the phone, it is the Nothing phone or the Nothing phone 2, and these are the Nothing Ear, but specifically the noise-canceling version of them. And I am very much a child of the 80s and 90s, and so I appreciate see-through technology as much as anyone else who remembers growing up in that particular era.
Oh, I had a see-through phone. Ah, that was like the coolest thing back then.
Yeah, so these are earbuds that are built on very similar concepts. If you look at them, they are it is you know, transparent plastic on the top that gives you a look into some of the electronics on the inside, and they just stand out a little more than most earbuds when you go to put them in your ears by, you know, variants of that design.
So they run about the same price, it looked to me, as a pair of Apple AirPods. What are the differences, considering that we're in the same price point?
Yeah, so the biggest difference here is that you're not going to get kind of the Apple ecosystem benefits. So you're not going to be able, if you own, you know, an iPhone and a MacBook or something, you're not going to have that ability to kind of jump back and forth between all of those things effortlessly. If you're using a set of Android phones and you know, kind of a different setup for your tablet or your laptop, you'll notice that the functionality is going to be very much the same. The sound quality is really great. The voice calling for actually using them to make phone calls in our tests were pretty great. What we did notice that this is missing over similarly priced headphones is the ability to change your noise canceling settings by touching the earbuds, which is something you can do with AirPods. You can hold down on the little stick and it'll, you know, engage or disengage noise canceling. This requires you to go into the app on your phone and turn on and off noise canceling, which is just not as convenient, but not necessarily a deal breaker, you know, for most folks.
How good is the noise canceling? Because I always have questions about in-ear noise canceling headphones as opposed to like the giant ones that go over your whole ear.
Over the last couple of years, in-ear noise canceling has gotten really, really good. It's never going to be exactly as good as the giant cans that you put on your head, if only because bigger batteries, more microphones, there's a lot more heavy lifting going on there. But these are very good. You will notice sound if you are on an airplane, you know, during takeoff or something like that. But if you are in a mall or a grocery store or, you know, just kind of out on the street, it does a very good job making the outside world go away.
And most importantly, for anyone who exercises, do they stick in your ears?
They do, in fact, stick in your ears. And that is something we test very carefully with all of our headphones, as both our primary headphone guy and myself love being outside with our headphones and do not love having to chase after them on busy New York streets. So, yeah, they stay in your ear. There aren't included ear tips for really large ears. So if you find yourself, when you buy headphones, usually kind of popping off the included tips and upgrading to one of the larger ones, you'll find that you'll have to buy those separately. But for most folks, these will fit really well.
Finally, I want to go a little off script and ask you about the House passing the foreign aid package that just happened to include giving TikTok a year to sell itself to an American company.
Yeah, they really slipped it in there. I find myself having the same position that I did when this version of this happened with the Senate. And that is that we now have multiple quotes from multiple leaders that have been in office for some time that have warned about secret meetings where they have heard briefings on, you know, these terrible things that TikTok are doing. And if those things are true, I think every single person would very much want to hear those things instead of kind of sitting in the dark wondering why it is that we trust Facebook more than we trust TikTok.
Yeah, and the latest version gives them a year to sell instead of 6 months. And I understand that was kind of important for a handful of senators. So I guess we'll have to see where it goes.
I think something perhaps more interesting than, you know, whether the Senate and the House and then President Biden are going to pass this legislation are the First Amendment counts from the ACLU that are currently being sent to court to counter this. I think that that's where a fair bit of the rest of this conversation is going to take place.
Oh, yeah. I super think this ends up in litigation ultimately at the U.S. Supreme Court, probably.
I think that's right.
And that is all we've got for this hour. I want to say thanks to Russell Holly, the managing editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to this hour of All Sides. And I also want to say thanks to our All Sides staff, which includes senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our interns Amani Bio, Chris Corcoran, Jacqueline Roshetsky, and David Stein. Video production by The Ohio Channel. And the board operator today was Chris Johnston. Thanks so much for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.